From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents the third segment in a series of conversations with Mortimer Adler about the Paideia Proposal, his new book on educational reform. Mortimer Adler is director of the Institute for Philosophical Research and chairman of the editorial board of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Writing on behalf of the Paideia Group, a committee of scholars, professionals, and educators, Professor Adler argues in the Paideia Proposal for single-track primary and secondary education. That's general, humanistic, and liberal. In addition to Mortimer Adler, the speakers in the following portion of the conversation are Penelope Smith, Werner Danhauser, Thomas Houlihan, and Pamela Mayer. Penelope Smith teaches courses in the humanities in the Asheboro, North Carolina High School, where she was chosen the state's outstanding secondary teacher in 1981. Werner Danhauser is a scholar at the National Humanities Center on leave from Cornell University. Thomas Houlihan is principal of the Clayton, North Carolina High School. Pamela Mayer is superintendent of schools in the towns of Chapel Hill and Carrboro, North Carolina. Here is Penelope Smith.
An underlying assumption in the entire proposal is that there is a methodology of teaching and acquiring knowledge that is a given, that should be consistent throughout this country. And perhaps implicit in that is that there's a body of knowledge that should be consistent throughout this country. And you suggest that this must be achieved in the proposal at the community level without resorting to a monolithic national educational system. Yet, as a citizen of this country, it seems to me that I have as much interest in what is happening to a youngster in Massachusetts as I do to what's happening to a youngster in Mississippi. If we are all going to have access to equal education, I should have some notion that there is an equal education in Massachusetts as well as in Mississippi. Can this be done if we don't resort at least to some kind of national imperative?
We face that problem. But we recognize that this country is, I think, incurably committed to a pluralistic educational system. If this were France, the French Parliament would pass the act, the Minister of Education would say, tomorrow you do this, and it would be done. We have a Department of Education in this country, we have a Department of Social Service. No such thing as a Ministry of Education in the United States, never will be. So we have 25,000 separate autonomous school districts. And we had, therefore, to grant them, it would be presumptuous of us to say, here is a monolithic curriculum adopted everywhere. Instead, I think we did something as good as that from your point of view. We said, here are things that you must do. There are a variety of things you can change, but here's the framework within which you construct a curriculum for your own school district. Those three kinds of learning, and I should add three more things, 12 years of physical education and personal hygiene, 8 years of manual training, widest variety, carpentry, sewing, cooking, machine repair, automobile driving, because we think that mind training is by words as well as by hands as well as by words, and 2 years at the end, not of vocational, specialized vocational training in the sense of training for a particular job, but a general introduction to the world of work. Now we say, if you vary this in a variety of ways, you can pick the kind of textbooks you want, you can arrange the school hours the way you want, but at least be sure that it does these things. That would give you the uniform quality we're asking throughout the United States, but we're done in a variety of ways instead of in one monolithic program. Does that meet your point, Ms. Smith?
Yet, if we do it that way, aren't we in fact having regional electives? And
Not electives.
No, but isn't it electives that have gotten us into this fix, at least according to the way the proposal's argued, and now you're allowing the regions to elect the books?
Yes.
To elect the way in which they're going to deliver this kind of teaching, and won't you get in the same fix?
No, because we're saying there should be, in the 12 years, mathematics up through calculus, natural science up through physics, history, both domestically and from a world point of view, world geography, a study of our social institutions in relation to geography and history. We're saying all these skills must be formed, and we're saying the understanding must be enlarged by the discussion, the consideration of ideas and values by the discussion method. Now, what books they choose, what works of art they choose to discuss, how they arrange the schedule. I mean, I think the degrees of latitude within that framework do not prevent us from saying there'll be a common quality with all those variations in it. At least I have to say this, but I don't see any alternative. We cannot. We are pluralistic. We've got to face that pluralism. And at the same time, I'm with you entirely in wishing to have the same quality for all the children of the United States.
Werner Danhauser, reflecting on the book, I noticed a conspicuous absence of religion, or even, if I recall correctly now, the word God. Now, the country may be operating under certain First Amendment restrictions, but certainly the authors of the Paideia proposal weren't. And I think it matters in this way. I think, and I want your agreement or disagreement, that you operate with a tacit agreement as to some kind of base that would be provided for religion, and at the other end, some kind of ethos consensus, let's say. And at the end, you seem to try really to replace religion. In other words, you talk so much about Paideia in the large sense, where it has to do a lot with living well. Mm-hmm. And living well has usually been thought to be the special province of religion, which, by the way, also sort of provided for the equivalent which you began by thinking about, by being something for everybody. And I am benignly skeptical about your ability to do these things that you aspire to without taking religion into consideration at all.
We, again, as in the case of my instance, Ms. Smith, we were very carefully, very deliberately conscious of some of the fundamental principles of this country's constitution. This is, again, this country is pluralistic with respect to religion and anti-religion. Atheists, agnostics, as well as religious persons, disbelievers as well as believers, are citizens of the United States, and public education must be impartial with all respect to this. Now, in the course of these 12 years, there should be no religious instruction in the public schools, but there should be instruction about religion, not religious instruction. But I would say that books like St. Augustine's Confessions, the Little Flowers of St. Francis, portions of the Summa Theologica, particularly the Treatise on God and the Treatise on Man and the Treatise on Angels, should be read. God certainly should be in many texts, the 10th book of Plato's Laws, the 8th book of Aristotle's Metaphysics, in the Summa and other books, and in Descartes' Meditations on the First Philosophy. I assure you, the idea of God would not be undiscussed, but not from the point of view of faith, because there are diversity of faiths and anti-faiths. And in our system of public, there are perfectly ample room for parochial schools who want to teach religion according to the sect of the community. But that's not for the public schools. In a democracy such as ours, the ideal would be no private schools that are not parochial. That's a class distinction that shouldn't exist. The public schools should be so good that there is the only reason for private schools is either the wrong reason of a social elitism or the justifiable reason that the public schools are not good enough for my child, and therefore willing to pay the money gap, which I can afford to pay, to give him a better education in a private school with smaller classes and better paid teachers and so forth. In our society, I think the retreat from the public schools to the private schools is a disaster. I'm leaving the parochial out. The justification of parochial schools, I say there's no justification for non-parochial private schools. The public schools should be good enough to make that unnecessary. The parochial private schools are justified on the grounds that we have a separation of church and state, and if Orthodox Jews or Orthodox Protestants or Orthodox Catholics want elements of their faith taught in the course of schooling, they should be privileged to have such schools exist. And certified, as all schools be certified by the same standards. That applies to the fundamentalist schools. They can't just be called schools and give diplomas without standard certification of what they're doing. I would say they shouldn't be certified if the elements of the Paideia proposal were thought worthy of being adopted and made a kind of a national goal. The fundamentalist schools should be held to the same aim, which they wouldn't like, because I don't think they want intellectual freedom. I mean, they're more intolerant than any of the Orthodox religions. But that's, I think I'd be going far afield if I said what I thought about fundamentalist schools.
Tom Houlihan, in chapter 5, you talk about, the book talks about overcoming initial impediments and the home and environmental factors, mm-hmm. the need for 1 to 3 years of preschool tutelage for those who are lacking. Yep. It, the book indicates that without proper preparation for schooling, the whole thing won't work.
I think that's true. I think, at least the various studies that I've read on this subject, when the child comes to school at age 6, if he doesn't go to kindergarten, or age kindergarten to 5, from an environment which is adverse to schooling, which anti-intellectual and anti-learning prejudices control his life, I think he's behind the eight ball, and there's some indication that school can't quite compensate for that initial deficiency. So I think we have a problem there. Plato in the 5th century BC, in his proposal for the education of the guardians of the state, the ruling class, decided to take children away from their parents at birth and have the state educate them in order to avoid the inequalities of homes. So it's an old idea that we do something about avoiding those natural disadvantages. I think there are many difficulties about it. I'm not sure we know the answer to all your questions, but I think it's important to keep at working at solving that problem, because there's no question that the first 4 or 5 years of adverse environment can be a great detriment to the child in school, which the school can't make up for.
Pam Mayer, Professor Please. Adler, it strikes me as I read your book that we may be talking about a level of commitment perhaps unknown to us at this point in time. Let me describe what I mean. I think we need to commend our society and to say that perhaps public education is the only commitment we've made to every single citizen. If we think of any other arena, it is the only one that comes to my mind, at least, which is clearly a commitment to every citizen. Yet, by the same token, I think if we are to reach the point of this enlightened citizenry, to me there must be demonstration beyond the public schools of a community of commitment by adults within this society. There must be a way for adults to say, we care about what young people are making of their lives. Not, we delegate to you public schools to make young people make something of their lives. To me, there is a critical difference.
I think you're right.
Between those two viewpoints. Now, is it possible, that this is a precursor to an ideal situation where every educated adult is a teacher at some point in this society?
Mm-hmm. Yes. In fact, we will never have enough teachers, professional teachers. And I think that with the length of human life increased, with reduction in hours of labor, it would be wonderful if every citizen were a teacher. And the reason for that, I really think that teaching is almost the greatest prerequisite for learning. I know that I have learned more from teaching than any of my students have learned from my teaching. Okay. There was a system in England in the 19th century that I don't know why it was dropped. It was called the Lancastrian system, in which every student one grade up was a kind of a preceptor for the student of the grade below, and went on that way so that every student had the experience both of being a learner and a teacher, and it had great advantages.
But that may in fact be the second sequel to this lifelong learning process,
a
community of instructors and learners together.
I agree with you completely. And I think if this is not our ideal, we are hypocritical Democrats. I think most of us are, by the way. I think a large part of the population of the United States pays lip service to democracy and they're not Democrats. At Aspen, for example, I will find most of the top executives of this country thinking that some of the children are not educable. I mean, you know, just train them vocationally, educate the few, train the others. Though they have just told me on a previous day that they think Aristotle is wrong, that some men are by nature slaves. You see, I mean, they don't realize the inconsistency of those two statements. Now, we hold that all the children are not educable to the same degree, but all are educable. They're all human and all educable. And therefore they deserve, according to their capacities, as much education as they can possibly take. These, it seems to me, are in our society, things that every citizen should be, shall I say, loyally committed to. And I think they can be aroused to do that and be told that if this is not true, give democracy up. Adopt some other form of government. It's ridiculous to have a citizenry that's incapable of being citizens because they are uneducable. I mean, an uneducable citizen is not a citizen.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the third part in a series of conversations with Mortimer Adler about his new book on educational reform, The Paideia Proposal. Citing Horace Mann, John Dewey, and Robert Hutchins, Adler argues in The Paideia Proposal for single-track, humanistic, and general primary and secondary education in American schools. In addition to Mortimer Adler, the panelists in this part of the discussion are Penelope Smith and Roy Harkin. Mortimer Adler directs the Institute for Philosophical Research and is chairman of the editorial board of Encyclopedia Britannica. Penelope Smith teaches in the Asheboro, North Carolina High School, where she was chosen the state's outstanding secondary teacher in 1981. Roy Harkin is dean of the School of Education at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Here is Penelope Smith.
Let me, as a teacher of those prospective citizens, raise some of their objections to this proposal.
Yep.
I think that your normal run-of-the-mill, all-American, good-guy citizen student would say that you're asking me to do too much, that what you're proposing is far too difficult, and besides, I have a job, I have to make car payments, there's Saturday night to take care of, Pac-Man is a lot more fun, television is delightful. I think that students, by and large, are going to say all of that. And I think they're not going to say something else that I think is also very true of students. I think, by and large, our students are going to be too afraid for this proposal to go into effect for this reason. The proposal suggests, and I think it's correctly named a manifesto, it suggests a revolution. And I think the revolution extends far beyond education.
It does.
You are arguing for a social and an ideological revolution. You are suggesting that our parents and our teachers and our students risk thinking.
Yes,
and I think that they are going to be mightily afraid of doing that, and consequently are going to offer up what I consider a bunch of nitty-gritty objections that I need some answers to. For example, you say this program might take 10 years for some, 14 years for others, and yet 25% of our young people are dropping out of school now, saying it's too much, too hard, and there's so many other things that I want to do. How are you going to keep them in school so that I can be assured of some level of equal education? And how are you going to keep those who have jobs and other exciting things doing the work it would entail to, in fact, put this proposal into effect?
Let me answer the last. Let me stop with your last 2 points. For at least 6 or 8, maybe even 10, not full 12 of those 12 years, I would like every boy and girl in school to have a job. Not to earn a living, not to be self-supporting, but for the experience of work, because I think the work experience is a maturing experience and gives responsibility and kind of habit formations that are important for study. Secondly, I think it's terribly important to say that many of the children that are dropouts drop out of boredom, not because it's too difficult, but because their minds aren't touched. If this, the kind of thing I'm talking about, begins in the first grade and is sustained through the 12 years, you won't have dropouts for that reason. We turn the children on instead of off. I think these things are all, I mean, there are a lot of modifications to this, a lot of things to put into it that make it more reasonable, more practical. Remember now, this is a first shot at the appeal. I mean, the main principles are here. I mean, I don't think this is the gospel truth. I don't think this is the Bible to be taken literally true or even figuratively true. I think it's a statement of fundamental commitment to an ideal with everyone's input to make it better and more feasible and more practical.
Your book makes it clear, and your earlier remarks makes it clear, that you consider the educational system presently to be in a deplorable state.
For our kind of society, yes.
And you propose in this manifesto the reform of that system by the implementation of a particular type of curriculum. Interdeliberations as a committee, did you consider any other forces that might be at work within the system or from without the system that may have may contribute to what you see as deplorable state of affairs? Is it realistic to consider or to believe that curriculum reform can fully address the concerns that you have? Is there anything else operating that needs to be considered?
Well, two things, certainly. Unemployment, and particularly the unemployment of certain sectors of our economy, the unemployment in the large cities of the blacks and the Hispanics. A young person who, knowing the figures, knowing the state of affairs, looks forward to being thrown on the junk heap at the end of high school is hardly motivated to go on learning. We've got to do something about that, and very quickly. We can't ask young people to prepare themselves to live well without also prepared to earn a living to live well. I think another consideration is, I think all of you had a sense that, all of you said one way or another, we've got to change the dominant values in the society. It's got to be a practical success society, get as much as I want, pile up the variety of goods I can buy, induce to do so by advertising. Then we have to have a different view of what a life is like, what a human life should be. But in other words, we went over this morning another way, we need a moral and social revolution along with an education revolution that you've been saying. The things are not separate.
But those two factors certainly are important social influences bearing on all our institutions. Well, one usually doesn't change values by direct intervention.
I know that.
Is it possible that the way the role is defined in the educational system of America, which is essentially a bureaucratic industrial model of organization, which places the teacher at subordinate, submissive level within that system, and severely constrains the decision-making power and the freedom of action of that individual, as well as providing a low level of compensation, has something to do with that. If those things, if you would agree that those things may be characteristics of our system, how would you propose to implement a curriculum pattern which essentially, as I interpret it, requires a very sophisticated level of decision-making on the part of the professional in a system where that individual is more or less looked at as a factory hand?
I have two answers to your question, neither of which is adequate, but they're stabs at the question. One is the role of the principal. One of the troubles, I think, that must be corrected is the principals of our schools are not genuinely principals, because the word principal is an adjective, and the noun it should modify, and the only noun it can modify, is teacher. The principal should be the principal teacher, or a comparable word, the headmaster. And our principals are clerks, administrators, supervisors of everything except education. I think we must make principals principal teachers. They should be classroom teachers. They should be the education leaders of the school community. They should have authority in the selection of the staff, and should be involved in the training of that staff. I think, secondly, that teaching is a skill that can't be acquired in schools of education. I think it must be acquired the way clinical skills are acquired in medicine. You can learn the medical sciences, but the art of being a physician is something that you learn in practice, as the art of being a lawyer is something you learn in practice. And clinical experience for the teachers is of the same kind. I would insist that every teacher have at least 3 years of clinical experience under supervision.
It seems to me there might be two consequences of defining the role of the principal that way, perhaps more than two. One is that the emphasis that your document places upon the role of the principal, and I noticed throughout that document a fairly clear hierarchical perspective. And it may suggest one of the consequences of the emphasis on the principal's role in this program may be to intensify the hierarchical nature of American education, which I believe, after a few years in this business, is part of the explanation of our problem. Nothing is said about enhancing the role of the teacher in this process.
You use the word hierarchical. I don't think that leadership is hierarchical. A school is a community. Any community needs a head, a leader. Any community that is performing a function. In any industrial operation, there are foremen and workers and supervisory staff. That kind of hierarchy is the very nature of any artistic performance. Democracy belongs to the political realm. Democracy does not belong to any functional organization. There shouldn't be democracy in the army. There shouldn't be democracy in the school. There shouldn't be democracy in a corporation.
It doesn't matter what the purpose of that organization might be. The patterns of the
any organization which has not any organization which has an artistic product as an end. Teaching is an art. Education is a practical. Anything that's producing something, achieving an end, unlike democracy, which is where everyone is trying to achieve the common good, deserves a non-democratic form of organization.
The same relationships that would hold true for the production line then at General Motors would hold true for the American elementary school.
No, I'm not saying the same. No, but I'm only saying there is nothing wrong with having different grades of teachers and having a principal who is a leader of the school community and a supervisory head of the school's community, and in some sense, it's principal teacher. I don't think there's anything anyone's hurt by that.
But Mr. Adler, when you say democracy belongs to the political realm, you reinforce my skepticism about the Paideia proposal.
Why?
Which is that it is transferring democracy to a realm of education.
It's the opposite.
The argument of in the chapter on individual differences strikes me as Aristotelian. I know you won't be offended by that.
Not at all.
I know.
That's a word of praise.
But it appeals, I know, it appeals to a human nature, which at the same time Aristotle and most of classical thought, if I understand it correctly, thinks of as hierarchical. The principle of ruling and being ruled runs throughout nature and other things.
Aristotle was wrong. I'm a devoted, as you know, a devout and devoted Aristotelian, but the worst error Aristotle made was the notion that some are by nature free and some are by nature slaves. He was not a democrat. He knew what a citizen was, but he was an elitist who thought there was a definite, in fact, he was almost, had a, shall I say, a bimodal distribution of the human race. So I'm not an Aristotelian on that point by any means. And the point I want to make is that this is committed to a democracy that Aristotle wouldn't have approved and wouldn't have understood. He would have said only some children are educable. Some are intended to be made servants and slaves. And I'm saying the very opposite of Aristotle on this point. But I am also saying that there is a human nature that has certain inherent propensities and capacities that need to be developed for all the children, that they're all educable. But I don't think that I'm disagreeing with either of you. I'm only saying that it is, for example, when during the 60s the youngsters wanted to sit on the board of trustees of university, that's a false notion of equality. The teachers and students should sit down and together decide what the curriculum should be is a false notion of democracy. It's like saying I go to the hospital, I should have an equal voice with the surgeon as to what tools he should use to operate. I mean, in any technical operation, there is a hierarchy of functions and a hierarchy of skills.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the third segment in a series of conversations with Mortimer Adler about the Paideia proposal, his new book on educational reform in American primary and secondary schooling. The National Humanities Center would like to hear from you. Send your comments to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.